He is not called Beep the Meep. He has never been called Beep the Meep. From 1979, when that comic strip was published, he was not called Beep the Meep. He is the most high Beep of all the Meeps. It's his rank. It means king. And it's a fandom invention that he's called Beep the Meep. And everyone calls him Beep the Meep. And I stand here on my lone soapbox going, no, I will not have this. His name is not Beep the Meep. He is the Meep. And nobody listens to me. And they'll go, yeah, but we're calling him Beep the Meep. But that's my little soapbox about the Meep.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who podcast network.
Well, hi everybody, and welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. This is the first episode to be released after the two-year anniversary of this podcast. That means I've been bringing you this weekly show every Sunday for exactly 2 years. We started with the very first of the Target releases from the year 1973, and we are now in the middle of the year 1985 in the Target world, but it is also November 2023, the 60th anniversary month of Doctor Who. So for this month only, I am taking a brief hiatus from the books, and we are talking about topics related to, directly or tangentially, Doctor Who's coming 60th anniversary. Last week, I brought you a conversation with New York Times best-selling author Adam Christopher, who has written novels in the Elementary and Stranger Things and Star Wars universes, also a longtime Doctor Who fan and former editor of the New Zealand Time-Space Visualizer fanzine. It was a terrific conversation. If you enjoyed it, please share and spread the word. This week, I was supposed to bring you my long-awaited special on Doctor Who's top 60 stories over the last 60 years, based upon a panel that I moderated at L.I. Who in August 2023, 3 months ago. I was going to have a special guest, and we were going to compare and contrast our mutual top 60s. Unfortunately, for the first time in the 2 years of this podcast, I missed the deadline due to unavoidable schedule conflicts with the guest. That episode will be recorded in a few days' time and should be released next Sunday. So this week, with nothing else in the hopper, I am giving you two interviews that I recorded at L.I. Who with guests in August 2023. You're going to hear from Gary Russell, and you're going to hear from Mickey Lewis, both Doctor Who novel authors. Gary wrote several novels for the Virgin Publishing and BBC Books line, and also has been writing novelizations, starting with the original novelization of the 1996 TV movie, the recent expanded Target edition of the TV movie novelization, and coming very soon, the novelization of The Star Beast, the episode that we now know is going to be airing on November 25th, 2023. As close in time as possible to Doctor Who's 60th anniversary. This conversation was held in August, so there were some things that I didn't know when I sat down with Gary, and there were also some things that Gary knew that he was not able to share with us at the time. You will hear Gary talk about Inferno. What I didn't know is that new Inferno material is coming between Cutaway Comics and Gary Russell, and of course, Jim Sangster. My other conversation at L.I. Who was with Mickey Lewis, who wrote two acclaimed Doctor Who novels for the BBC Books line in the very early 2000s, and who you have seen on screen several times under various monster guises in the new series. So that'll be this week. Conversations with Gary Russell and Mickey Lewis. Had a great time sitting down with each of them. This year, the interviews with guests at L.I. Who was conducted on the back patio of the hotel. You will hear a lot of background chatter. This is particularly evident in the conversation with Mickey Lewis. Somebody appeared to be doing their best impression of Marlon Brando in The Wild One, and there is a motorcycle backfiring almost continuously during the earlier parts of that conversation. I did my best, with audacity, to try and minimize that. Unfortunately, my best was not quite up to the task of erasing the Marlon Brando wannabe, or if you will, Jax Teller from Sons of Anarchy. If you prefer your pop culture references a little bit more contemporary than the early 1950s. But it's a very good interview, even if I do say so myself. 99% of the quality of that interview is entirely down to Mickey Lewis. So this episode is being released one day after my typical Sunday release schedule. I hope you'll pardon the interruption. Next week should be Doctor Who 60 for 60. I will have some other guest interviews and 60th anniversary topics for episodes coming out the next two Sundays after yesterday. And then in December, we should be resuming our usual target course. We're going to have some longtime friends of the show coming back in December as we return to the 1985 targets. Jim Sangster will be first up. I also see Pete Lambert on the schedule. I see Cy Hart on the schedule, looking to extend his record as the most frequent interview guest on this show. And then coming up after that will be book number 100. Target book number 100, The Two Doctors. That is currently in the works as a bumper episode featuring multiple guests discussing the same book, similar as we did with The Five Doctors, which was episodes 81A, B, and C. of this podcast. In the meantime, I hope you enjoyed this slightly belated episode featuring slightly belated releases of interviews that I did at LI Who in August 2023. Next week, we'll be back at you with more 60th anniversary goodness coming up on the November 23rd release of The Star Beast, for which Gary Russell's novelization, I believe, is due out in January 2024. You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky and Mastodon as Doctor Who Novels, Dr. Who Novels. Please contact us on Gmail at Doctor Who Literature, that's Dr. Who Literature at gmail.com. This podcast is produced by Dave Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. Our logo is designed by Jim Sangster. This week's episode was written and produced by myself. And now, Gary Russell and Mickey Lewis, let's get to it.
They all say, who is Doctor?
This is Tim Treloar.
This is David J. Howe.
I'm Peter Purvis.
I am Sadie Miller.
This is Lauren Cornelius.
Larry, it's Fraser.
For all things in the Doctor Who collecting world and beyond, the Doctor Who Collectors Podcast. I'm Larry Van Mersbergen, your host, and I've been collecting for 42 years. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature on the Direction Point Podcast Network. Keep turning the pages.
So I'm sitting here at LI Who 2023 with the great Gary Russell. Gary, thanks very much for sitting down with me.
Jason, it's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
When did you first discover the Target novelizations?
That would have been in 1974, I think. And I walked into my local branch of Woolworths, which in the UK in those days was a big, not a department store, but they sold everything. You know, you could get absolutely everything in Woolworths. And they had books. And I walked in and I suddenly saw these Doctor Who books. I saw Doctor Who in the Day of the Daleks and Doctor Who in the Doomsday Weapon. And I thought, oh my God, Doctor Who books. So that was an instant sort of, I have to have this. But then it was like, I've only got 30p on me and these are 25 pence each. Oh my God, which am I going to have? So Day of the Daleks was the title I recognised. I didn't know what the Doomsday Weapon... I thought, there isn't a story called the Doomsday Weapon. I have my Radio Times 10th anniversary special. I know there is no story called the Doomsday Weapon. So that must be a made-up story. So I bought Day of the Daleks. I went home. I read it. Read it again. Read it again. Thought this was the most astonishingly brilliant thing I've ever seen. So I begged and borrowed from my mum. And the following week, I went back to Woolworths to see if I could find this Doctor Who and the Doomsday Weapon and see what that was. And I bought it. And then I also saw Doctor Who in An Exciting Adventure with the Daleks and Doctor Who and the Crusaders and Doctor Who and the Zabi. And I went, oh, there's lots of these books. And that's that old bloke that is in the Radio Times special, but I don't really remember ever seeing. I'll come back for those another day. And that was the start of the addiction. And every week in those early 1974 days, one book would get picked up. I think I went for Zabi next. Then I found Auton Invasion of and Cave Monsters, so they were, because it was Pertwee. Then I went back and got the Daleks. And then the Crusaders was one I left for a long time because I thought, well, it's historical. Who cares? I don't want a historical story. I like science fiction adventure. And then I finally bought the Crusaders and went, you idiot, this is the best book in the entire run. And then that was it. There were no other books. There was this little in preparation list at the front. So every week I would go back and I would check either Woolworths or W.H. Smith's and see if I could find these books that were in preparation. And then one day I found the Sea Devils. And I was like, oh, another book exists. Had to have it. And then one week, I'm telling you this very long and boring and rambling story for no reason whatsoever. I went back and there was a copy of The Demons. And The Demons I remembered so clearly and thought, wow, I've got to have that. But I didn't have 30 pence on me. So I hid the book away from all the other Doctor Who books. And my dad was in town somewhere and I ran all the way through Maidenhead, which is the town I lived in, to meet him at the library to beg him to give me 30p, which in those days 30p was a lot of money. And he slightly disgruntledly did, because I was, demons, see any copy. So he gave me this 30p and I ran all the way back through Maidenhead up to W.H. Smith's, went to where I'd hidden the book, and was gone.
Oh.
And I didn't exactly weep, but I was very unhappy, and my dad got the brunt of how unhappy I was. And so from that moment on, various members of family and extended friends were set out by my mum to find Doctor Who books. So they all had a list of the ones I'd got, and then my Uncle Roy used to come in every Friday. And one day he brought in The Demons, and then suddenly, I think I saw Giant Robot, he brought in Cybermen, I brought in Giant Robot, and it was like, I'd have to tell him every week which ones I got, and he helped me for about a year to build these Doctor Who books up. And then, of course, they suddenly started coming out monthly, and boom, the world was there.
So you have worn a prodigious amount of Doctor Who hats in your professional career. And I'll just interject, the reason I know about Woolworths is from a novelization, Doctor Who and the Dinosaur Invasion.
Of course.
As the Doctor and Sarah are walking through a deserted London, Sarah is excited by Woolworths and not by traveling in time.
That's right. That's right. And isn't that where she also goes to nick something and the Doctor insists that she puts the money there? Is that in Woolworths or is that somewhere else? Oh, I can't remember. That's a great book. Dinosaur Invasion, that novelization is the inspiration, really. That and Cave Monsters, for me, are the two books that made me want to write. And I love Terence's stuff. Day of the Daleks and Auton Invasion are fantastic books. But there's something about Malcolm Hulk's use of character and point of view. And I always remember brilliant line. He always had brilliant lines. It's a brilliant line in Cave Monsters where Miss Dawson talks about how scared she is that people will stop saying, why don't you get married, and say, why didn't you get married? And that one line burned into my mind, and I thought, that is brilliant. Everything I need to know about Miss Dawson is in that one line. And similarly, in Colony or Doomsday Weapon, he has that brilliant thing about people in Dent's future. Captain Dent had a wife, and their marriage was just the stapling together of two pieces of paper. And I was like, this is fantastic. And Dinosaur Invasion with Butler with his scar falling, the fireman that fell through the glass, and he's the villain, but he was saving a child's life. And you said, that is clever writing for kids. That's Malcolm Hart knew how to write stuff for kids without ever talking down to them. And that inspired me so much. And my own writing has always been very heavily, I would like to say, based and inspired, some might say ripping off Malcolm Hulk completely.
And the very end of Dinosaur Invasion, where the Doctor and Sarah break into a bookstore to solve the mystery of the plot by reading from the New Testament.
Hmm. I'd forgotten that.
To explain where Professor Whittaker went.
That's right. God, that's clever, that book. That's so clever. That use Malcolm Hulk has of point of view for characters. And then even when he's doing books that aren't his, like The Green Death, and you have a whole section that's from the point of view of the maggot. Mm. And you just think, that's smart. But that kind of goes back, years later, when I was at school, finishing school, doing my exams at school, and we had to study the Woman in White, Wilkie Collins' brilliant book, in which he does that all the way through. Every chapter is from a different point of view, including at one point a chair, and another one is a point of view of a gravestone.
Wow.
And at 16 years old, when I was reading that, my mind was blown and thinking, yes, this is the way to write fiction. Everyone else in the class was rubbish. And I just thought, how can a gravestone tell the story? And I was like, because that's clever writing. And that is, that's that Mark Hulk thing of just point of view characters that you don't expect. Love it.
So speaking of the many Doctor Who hats that you've worn over the last X number of years, you were the reviewer of the Target novelizations in DWM.
I was, towards the end of their run, yes. And I, as a result of that, I got to meet, Peter Ling and John Lucarotti and all of those people. And we had a lovely time. They were lovely people. Didn't meet Paul Erickson for some reason. I must have interviewed him, but I think we must have done it over the phone. I seem to remember sitting in Nigel Robinson's office at WH Allen and doing Paul Erickson on the phone, whereas Lucarotti I went out with for an evening, and I remember that very clearly, probably more clearly than he did, because I don't drink and he did. And Peter Ling took me out for a curry once, and they were those gentlemen, old school gentlemen, writing these Target novels. Were fans of Donald Cotton, a lovely man, absolutely lovely. And it was nice that in the twilight, I suppose, of their careers, they came back to revisit this amazing stuff that they'd done back in the 60s, and here they were getting a chance to write it all over again.
See, I would be intimidated by John Lucarotti because the amount of detail and embellishment and period descriptions that he puts in his novelizations, even when I was 11, 12 years old, was incredibly impressive to me.
He wasn't intimidating, he was funny. He's a man with an exceptional dry sense of humour, which appealed to me, because we have very similar senses of humour. I just got on famously with him, and then I saw him at a few conventions, and we always hung out. He was a smashing bloke.
So fast-forwarding a little bit, you became a Doctor Who novelisation author yourself,
yes.
Starting with the 1996 TV movie.
Which, of course, wasn't a Target in those days. It was just a BBC book. But it felt like a Target. It didn't look like a Target, but it felt like a Target. And for me, that was enough. That was everything I'd ever wanted to do as a kid. Suddenly, I was doing it. And I've said this a few times. I was living in London by the time I wrote that, because obviously I was in my 30s. But when it came out, I went home, back to Maidenhead, back to my mum's house, and I went down to W.H. Smith's in Maidenhead to see if they had a copy, and do what I'd always told the 10-year-old Gary had always said, which is I would go there, and any copy they had, I would turn so the cover was facing out, and I'd cover up everyone else's books. And I did exactly that, and I have never been so happy. And I still do it today. If I'm in a bookshop, I did it, I was in Manhattan on Thursday, and I went into a bookshop, I went to Barnes & Noble there, and they had a copy of the TV, the current version of the TV movie novelisation, and the two Eric Saywood ones. And the two Eric Saywood ones were facing front, and mine was spine in, and I went, nope, and put mine facing front, and took a little photograph, and went, yes.
Now, being a native New Yorker myself, which Barnes & Noble was this?
The one on Fifth.
Fifth Avenue?
Yes.
All right. I go to the Union Square one, which is 14th Street, not too far from Forbidden Planet and the Strand.
I didn't get to go that far down because I was jet-lagged to hell, so I was hovering around the 40s, and I just thought, on my way back to Grand Central, I thought, I'll stop off at Barnes & Noble. And there it was. Yes! A copy of my book in another country.
Next time I am in the Union Square Barnes & Noble, I will do the same thing. I will block out Eric Saywood's...
Well, it doesn't matter that it's Eric's. You have to block out everybody's. With mine.
His especially, though.
That's all that matters, is just blocking out everybody's books and putting mine facing forward so that everyone goes, there's a Gary Russell book, we must buy it. And I get very happy.
So I remember many years ago going to Visions 1996 in Chicago, where you and Philip Siegel and Yi-Gi Cho were guests. And I recall you, they had talent shows back then for the guests of honor.
Yes.
And you read out portions of the novelization that didn't make the final cut, including descriptions of the previous, I guess at that point, seven doctors.
Yeah.
But what blows me away is you saved that material and you reinstated it to the Target release of the TV movie last year.
I would love to tell you that I saved it. I didn't. My friend Kathy Sullivan saved it. Or she had a link to it. I think I put it up on a very old website of mine back in the 90s that was long since dead. And she still had a live link to it. And she found me all these bits from the TV movie. So that's how they went in. Bless Kathy for that. So yeah, it was great because when they said to me, you know, we're going to reprint the McGann movie as a Target, I was, woohoo, finally I'm a Target. And they said, look, you know, do you want to, this is an opportunity to put back in all the stuff that you originally had to cut out. And I said, yes, I'd like to do that. And I'd also like to tweak the whole thing because my geography of San Francisco in 1996 was not what it is in 2020 when I read the book. And I had so many things wrong. I remember being chastised very heavily by somebody online because I had referred to the Golden Gate Bridge going over a river. And I was told, no, it is a bay, it is not a river. And I thought, well, that's the first thing I've got to check. But I did a search, you see, because I'm completely anal about this. So I did a search of criticisms of the 1996 TV movie novelization, knowing that that would lead me to lots of reviews where people would point out all the things I'd got wrong, and that was a godsend, because, oh, right, so I got that wrong, did I? Well, we can change that. And I got that wrong, did I? I didn't get that wrong. That's perfectly right, but, you know, you're wrong. And it was marvellous, and so I was able to do all these tiny little tweaks that just made the book a bit better.
Speaking as somebody who was an American college student in the 1990s, there are two things you do not give an American college student in the 1990s. A keyboard and an audience.
I think that's true of the internet generally, and social media more so these days. I think if everything had a 24-hour delay on it, you hit post, but nothing goes live for 24 hours, and you've got 24 hours to think about what you've just posted, I think the whole internet would be a much better place, because I think a lot of people go, you know what, I wrote that yesterday, I've woken up this morning, I don't really mean that, that's a bit shit, and you change it. Some people wouldn't, obviously. I'm sure Elon Musk and Donald Trump would never change it, but normal, sensible people would absolutely change what they wrote, and we'd have a much happier world.
A much happier world without Donald Trump in it, yes.
Well, obviously, that goes without saying.
So, I realize there are probably many things you cannot tell us about your forthcoming novelization, so I'll be very, very, very brief. But you are novelizing something called The Star Beast, which is I believe it's the first of the new RTD episodes due to air about 3 months from now. How did that contract come about?
What can I say about that? It was Russell's idea that I did it, which is incredibly flattering. And I was contacted by Scott Hancock, his script editor, who said, are you busy? And I was like, no. Okay. Oh, that is it. And the next thing I knew, Russell was on the phone going, right, I'd like you to do this. We'll sort out, are you up for this? Sort out BBC Books. I was like, yes. And then BBC Books got in touch and said, oh, how would you like to... And I said, I've spoken to Russell. And they were like, all right, well, we'll cut all that out then. So we'll just go straight to the... Are you going to do it? Yes, right, here's the contract. And it was just... It was lovely. It was absolutely lovely.
Were you given a page count to aim for? Most of the old Targets tapped out at 128 pages. I imagine you had
not
a
given a page
space.
Count, given a word count, which word was 35K. Which I think is probably standard for the modern Targets. I think that's what... Kablam and Witchfinders and Zygon, What's It, and all of those, they're all 35K.
Were you working from a shooting script? Were you given carte blanche to make embellishments or additions?
Those are questions I cannot answer.
Understood. We'll revisit that after the books come out.
After the books come out, I will talk happily about every aspect of it. But yes, I have signed NDAs in blood. That I can't answer questions like that, I'm afraid.
Can you address the emotion that is involved in novelizing a brand new cutting-edge story?
Well, Yes, I mean, phenomenal. And it's Russell. The man is my mentor and my god, and a man I have been friends with for 20 years, more than 20 years, well over 20 years. So long before I went to work for him, long before Doctor Who came back. And I have nothing but love and admiration and utter respect for him. So to be asked to do it was the honour. I mean, I've novelised Russell before because I've novelised his Sarah Jane adventures.
Yes, yes.
And that was terrifying enough. This was more terrifying. But of course, the added excitement and thrill of this one is, as well as novelising Russell's script, I have in the back of my mind that there was also a comic strip that I loved by Mills and Wagner and Dave Gibbons. And so all of this is sort of swarming around in your head.
And there is a guest at this convention dressed as the Star Beast.
Is there really?
Yes.
I have not seen that.
Peep the Meep, I believe, the big blue costume.
I will say this, because this is not breaking any NDAs. He is not called Beep the Meep. He has never been called Beep the Meep. From 1979, when that comic strip was published, he was not called Beep the Meep. He is the most high beep of all the meeps. It's his rank. It means king. And it's a fandom invention that is called Beep the Meep, and everyone calls him Beep the Meep. And I stand here on my lone soapbox going, no, I will not have this. His name is not Beep the Meep. He is the Meep. And nobody listens to me, and they'll go, yeah, 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 but we're calling him Beep the Meep. But that's my little soapbox about the Meep.
I will sit here happily corrected. So I am reading the Target books one a week for a Doctor Who Literature podcast. So that means I read 120 pages every week for a Sunday morning release. These books are immediate in my mind. And some turns of phrase I recall from 30, 35 years ago, which is how much those books have burned into my consciousness. What are some of the Target books that you still carry with you in your head all these years later?
All of the Mac Hulks, without a doubt. Auton Invasion and Day of the Daleks. I did an introduction for the reprint of Day of the Daleks because they said to me, which one would you like to do? And I said, I'd really like to do Day of the Daleks because it was my first. And it opened my eyes to Terence's marvellous ability to take... I mean, of all the Target novels I think Terence ever wrote, the difference between Day of the Daleks, the novel, and Day of the Daleks on television is phenomenal. I mean, really, it's a précis of the TV show, and the rest of it is all Terence's new stuff. So I've always loved that. I think it's... I would say, what have I kept with me? I've kept with me all of the Black Logo books. When it went to the sort of, what I always call the bridge logo, I don't know what the official term for it is, the one that's broken down from the diamond logo. There are odd ones that I will remember, like Dinosaur Invasion, and I always quite liked his novelisation of Carnival of Monsters. And it's no sort of in-depth expansion of Carnival of Monsters, but Terence just writes it so charmingly and so nicely that it's a good one. Three Doctors is always a good one. And then I sort of, by the time we get towards the 80s, roughly really when I started reviewing for the DWM, is where for me they sort of blur, because it suddenly became a job rather than a pleasure to read these books. And I was reading them in manuscript form. So I don't have that nostalgic feeling of picking up a copy of The Savages or picking up a copy of Harry Sullivan's War or any of those things as physical books. I had manuscripts and was removed from that and have therefore never read those books. They all sit beautifully on my shelf in both hardback and paperback, but that's a whole different experience for me. So for me, it kind of, by the time you've got to the 80s neon logo, my brain has started to just go, these are just Doctor Who books, and I buy it every month and I'll read it, or I'm reviewing it for DDR as a manager. So there's no nostalgic attachment to them at all.
I came in the mid 80s with the neon tube logos, so we have different perspectives on it. But,
and also I'm not averse to pointing out when they're rubbish. I mean, Robots of Death, probably my second or third favourite Doctor Who story of all time. The novelisation is utter pants. It is sadly Terence going, I've got a week to write this book, and it shows. And characters who are dead come back to life mysteriously, and it's basically a he said, she said novelisation. And I think, oh, what a shame, because that's a book that would have made a marvellously expanded, you know, give it to Boucher to do and make a marvellously expanded topic novel of that. But sadly, that won't happen now. So yes, I'm not sort of, I don't hold everything with starry-eyed glitter.
Reading Terence in publication order, he goes from 160 pages to 80 pages and back to 120. So I just finished Inferno last week.
That's not a good book.
Really?
No. You see, my favourite all-time Doctor Who story, so I'm biased against the fact that he cuts huge chunks out of it. He doesn't develop any of it. You get no sense of background or history to this alternate world, which I think is such a shame. When you compare that to Day of the Daleks, where you've got the entire history of the alternate future, here we have an entire alternate present, and Terence just knocks it out. And I think, oh, that's such a shame. Yeah, not one of my favourites, whereas, say, it is my all-time favourite telly story.
Well, Gary Russell, I can't thank you enough for sitting down with me.
Jason, it's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Hopefully we'll have you back on real soon. Enjoy the rest of the convention.
Yeah, happy to come and talk about Star Beast once it's published.
Excellent. Talk soon. And I'm sitting here at L.I. Who with Mickey Lewis. Mickey, welcome to Doctor Who Literature.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
I will tell you that I was living... Well, I met my wife, then-girlfriend, in the summer of 2001. She was living in Lower Manhattan. And she was at work one night, working late. And I was looking for something to do. And she told me to go... She said, there's a bookstore nearby. Walk south on Broadway until you see the two really big towers... And there's a Borders on the ground floor. I went into Borders and I bought Rags, which was fairly new at that time, your first past Doctor Adventure.
2001, I believe. Yeah.
That was the end of August 2001.
Yeah.
And then I read after 9/11, I didn't get to the books for a while. When I read the book, I said, if I was ever going to buy a book in a graveyard, this is the book to read. This is downbeat. This is really gripping. And then 2 years later, I read Combat Rock, which made Rags appear to be a light comedy. So let me ask you, how did you get into the world of Doctor Who books?
I'd done a couple of pitches, which were unsuccessful. And I'd written a horror novel called Rags. And I'd had a couple of rejections on that. I'd only sent it to a couple of publishers. I thought, do you know what? Maybe I should turn this into a Doctor Who pitch. So I did. And within, I sent it off to the editor at the time, Justin Richards. Within, I think it was only a week or so, I heard back. He said, yeah, I love it. I want you to write it. I thought, brilliant.
How did you choose the team of the Third Doctor and Joe?
Well, a lot of people have criticised me for those two books for the simple reason that they're putting their beloved Doctors, particularly the Patrick Troughton team, the most innocent team, has been quoted at me. What have you done to the most innocent team in Doctor Who? And my answer is, I used those combinations, the Third Doctor, Joe, Brigadier, Mike Yates, Troughton, Fraser. I'm mixing up the real names and the fake names, but what the hell, you know what I mean. And Victoria. And because I particularly loved those eras and those combinations, those families, that's why I had the hugest affection for them, so I wanted to use those. If I didn't like them, I wouldn't have used them.
And you gave Victoria a spine and a real backbone in Combat Rock, which I really appreciated.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because the trend of the books was to treat her as a peril monkey.
Yes.
But you put her in a horrible situation, and she really shone.
I'm glad to hear that was appreciated, because a lot of people were saying, what have you done to Victoria? That's disgusting, and how dare you? But thank you for pointing out that she did fight back, and that she rose to the occasion, as you said. So I'm sure that... Deborah Watling, the lovely late Deborah Watling, would have loved to have had a little bit more strength to her character, been allowed to show more strength to her character.
That might have been
always following in Fraser's tales, from Fraser's tales.
That might have been a hard story to film in Lime Grove Studio D, but the book fortunately had no budget cuts.
Absolutely.
When did you become a Doctor Who fan?
When I was 5 years old. 5 or 6 years old. My earliest memories, I'm not going to reveal which ones those are. So my age will always be a secret. It has to be in this industry or you never work again.
Of course.
It's such a discriminatory industry. But Pertwee particularly, absolutely loved Pertwee era. So just grew up with the Target novelizations, the Terence Dix, Malcolm Holt, all of those, and still got them in immaculate condition. Kept them all these years. I've always been a fan. I remember. Oh, that's annoying, isn't it? Thank you very much.
Somebody is backfiring a motorcycle right by our outdoor patio table.
Yeah, brilliant.
So, just to bring back a moment, so you were a big fan of the Target books, and this is a Target book podcast.
Okay.
So, I'm very glad to hear that. What are some of your favorite Targets of all time?
It's difficult to differentiate the contents from the amazing covers, Chris Achillion. So it's a two-part answer, really. Favourite covers and the favourite actual novelisations. Right. Favourite novelisation is probably The Autumn Invasion. It's one of, well, actually, the Daleks and the Crusaders and the Zabi were the first ones of all. But Autumn Invasion and the Cave Monsters were the first ones that really made me fall in love with the novelisation. So particularly those two, the Abominable Snowman as well, and the Demons. All of those. Then I started to fall a little bit out of love with them when Terence started getting a little bit lazy. Started writing 100-page novelisations. I thought, oh, come on. And then I started getting older, and I thought I should really be reading something a bit denser and, you know, a bit more complex. But I'll just say this. I remember reviewing Pyramids of Mars by Terence Dix for a school project, and I say, it's time you've moved on from this sort of thing. I thought, oh, okay. Can I just say the covers? Achillios, what a genius. I mean, I've got the Clack t-shirt at home.
I wore that yesterday.
Did you? That's amazing, isn't it? And I've been collecting the mugs off lovely Patricia, Tasha, sorry, I should kill me for that. Tasha, his widow. I struck up a good friendship with her, and I always go around and pester her. I want some more mugs, more posters, because, you know, he's my favourite artist, Doctor Who artist of all time. I just mentioned Jeff Cummins as well. I can't believe how lovely Jeff. I love his stuff as well.
I got to meet him at Gallifrey 1 back in February. Delightful man.
Oh, he's lovely. Yeah, and I particularly like the Horror Fang Rock one and Face of Evil. So I've got to mention Jeff. Come on, that wouldn't be so unfair.
So as a horror writer, who were your biggest influences when you sat down to write your novels?
Ramsay Campbell. I don't know if you've heard of Ramsay Campbell. He's a Liverpudlian British author. He was widely touted by Stephen King in one of Stephen King's books on writing, saying this man particularly talented writer, you should all seek him out. But he's not for all tastes, because his writing is very, it will lead you down dark alleys in the mind. It really, it's not gory. It's the literary equivalent of having an acid tab, I would say. Taking an acid tab, it really does mess with your mind. The surrealness, the sense of dread. He just captures these faceless, homogenous streets in, you know, urban homogenous streets perfectly. Amazing. All the houses looking the same, the estates, you know, and then he puts tormented characters in those settings. So, yeah, he's brilliant. And Stephen King, of course. He's the master of characterization. So,
what are some of your favorite Stephen King novels?
I don't particularly have any favourite novels. I just admire his writing, because he does get criticised for being too simplistic. Oh, Stephen King. Anyone reads Stephen King. There's a lot more to his writing than appears on the surface. The masterful characterisation, the plot lines, the folksy storytelling that really grips you straight away. I mean, that's not easy to do. Dickens could do it. King can do it. He's the modern Dickens in many ways, in my mind.
I would also add that Stephen King tells you in his stories who his favorite authors and novels are. So he's a gateway drug to a higher
Absolutely.
Level of literature.
Yes. Yeah, I tend to do that with music. I should do it more with writers in my books. I tend to reference favorite bands. Yeah, I should reference writers more. Ramsey Campbell. I'm doing an article on Ramsey Campbell at the moment for the Dark Side magazine in Britain, so check that out when it's out.
Please, I certainly do. Will. I'll promote that on the podcast. You are one of the few Doctor Who novel writers who also has been a Doctor Who actor on television. Did you envision as a child you were going to be both on screen and writing the words?
Never in a million years. I remember being very precociously saying to my parents when I was about 13, when I grow up, I'm going to write for Doctor Who, meaning the scripts, that, you know, being a script writer. I never imagined I'd end up writing two novels. Never in a million years would I have dreamed of becoming one of the main monsters on recurring monsters. So, yeah, it's just one of those weird twists of fate that led me to where I am now.
In a word or two, how did you become involved as an actor on the show?
It really was as simple as getting a call from my agent saying, would you like to be on Doctor Who? It's as simple as that, as a monster. They didn't tell me what monster. I said, yes, of course, of course. It was actually a recorded message. I was out at the time, and this was before I even had my mobile phone wasn't working. They used my landline, so I got home to find this recorded message. Would you like to do it? So of course I phoned them back and said yes. Didn't tell me what it was until I turned up a week or so later, and the AD said, you know you can be a Dalek, don't you? Like, oh.
Oh, wow.
Okay. My first ever job on Doctor Who as a Dalek, and one of the Dalek animated puppets, corpses, in the crashed spaceship in the snow.
Asylum of
the Daleks. That's it.
And who were some of your favorite monsters to play?
I loved bringing back the Sea Devils. That was a real honor, because I loved them as a child, being a Pertwee fan. And I thought the Sea Devils were so iconic. And I was thinking, why haven't they been brought back before now? And then suddenly, Ray Holman, the designer, I was doing a Cyberman episode, and he said, oh, this is what you'll be doing next. And he took me over to his desk, showed me this incredible sketch of the new Sea Devil, and my jaw dropped.
Ah.
And he incorporated so much of the original design in cleverly and tweaked it a little bit, just to make it a slightly more piratical. But I loved it, so that was one of my favorites. Cybermen, of course, especially the Ascension of the Cybermen design. I thought that was wonderful, with the retrograde helmet and the little spikes. Yeah, that was fantastic. And the black ones, the Cybermasters.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I think we have time for two more questions before your next event.
Okay.
In the old days, in the studio under the hot lights, you would hear about the monster artists literally sweating gallons into their boots.
Oh, yes.
What is the physical discomfort level of playing a monster in 21st century Who?
Well, the Sea Devil, again, we filmed it on the hottest day of the year, under the hot studio lights as well. It was insanely hot. So when we weren't being used, we just sat and we had to go into a little zen space inside ourselves because it was so incredibly suffocatingly hot. We couldn't take the heads off because we needed back imminently, and it's such a, you know, it was a faffle getting them on and off, which is fine. So I just went to this little zen space, monster zen I call it, where I'm sitting on a beach, cold beach, cold overcast day. You get a lot of those in South Wales. Instead of in this hot studio wearing a Sea Devil head.
And we have time for one last question. I heard you mention this on yesterday's Saturday panel. Doctor Who books are still being written. Would you like to come back and write a third?
Funny you should say that. I have approached them. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. They do kind of like the marketing angle of a monster writing for the new novelizations. And a friend of mine, Mark Morris, is doing one. So, I put it out there, and I'm waiting to hear what might happen, but nothing's definite. But
well,
it'd be amazing.
Mickey Lewis, I look forward to seeing you on my screens, hopefully in November, and I look forward to a book, hopefully, in the next year or two.
Thank you very much, Jason. Lovely to meet you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Direction Point! Direction Point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.